Welcome to The Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. Before we start today's show, I wanted to say a few words about ads. For the past few months, you've heard them on the show, and some of you have asked why we started putting them in and why we can't put them in all at the beginning or the end of the show like some other podcasts do. So here's why we have ads now. By late last year, I realized that we couldn't continue doing the show unless we found a new revenue source. And while a number of you had generously donated to the show, and still do, which we greatly appreciate, it wasn't nearly enough to keep us afloat. And I'd more or less decided that we'd probably be shutting down sometime in the spring of 2017 after the presidential election, unless something changed. Now, in early February of this year, the podcasting company Audioboom approached us. After Jay and I talked about their offer, we decided that this could be the lifeline the show needed. And in the last few months, we've started to see some revenue from advertisers, and that's been enough to keep us going, which is really good news. But to ensure that we're still here to cover the 2018 midterms and beyond, we still need to do a lot of work to increase our audience size, and we need listeners like you to check out our sponsors, because obviously they're only going to stay with us if it's profitable to them. That's capitalism for you. Now, as for why we can't put the ads at the beginning or the end of the show, it's because the data shows that they're considerably less effective there, because people tend to skip past them. And so as part of our contractual agreement with Audioboom and the agreement Audioboom makes with advertisers, we can't run ads all together at the beginning or the end, and there are specific requirements about when during the show they actually need to appear. So we hope you understand this, and we also hope you'll consider supporting the show by going to our sponsors and using our special URLs or promo codes when you make purchases from them. You know, my goal is for the Politics Guys to be on at least long enough to discuss the House Democratic majority in 2018 and the election of President Cory Booker or Kamala Harris in 2020. And I guess if you're one of our conservative listeners, I'm sure you'll really enjoy me trying to explain why these things didn't occur, if in fact I'm wrong about that. But to do that, we need to have ads and we need your support of our advertisers when possible. Thanks very much. With me today is my co-host, attorney and Republican strategist, Jay Carson. This week's big story is Senate Republicans releasing their crafted-in-secret health care bill, which Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says will be voted on sometime next week. Now, after the House passed its Obamacare replacement, the general view was that the Senate would be, Senate's version would be less, mean, to use President Trump's explanation of it. But that turned out to not be the case, at least according to most people on the left, including me. The proposed legislation really isn't that big of a change from what the House passed, and already there are a number of Republican senators expressing doubts about it. And, you know, with a slim 52-48 majority in the chamber, all it will take is three Republican no votes to essentially scuttle the bill. Now, there's a ton going on here, and it's really easy to get lost in all the details. So what I'd like to do is to pull back and try to present a big picture view of things before Jay and I get to our thoughts on the Senate bill. So, Jay, does that sound good to you?
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Okay, and so just stop me if you think I'm wrong or unclear on anything, or you know, you'd like to add a point to kind of this general overview here, you know, because I'm not, this isn't designed to be a partisan thing, just kind of a getting everyone sort of up to speed background, that sort of thing. So,
right. No, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what I'll cover here is first, what Obamacare did. Second, how it was designed. Third, what the results have been so far, and finally, how the Senate bill will change things. Okay, so what Obamacare did. Now, as I see it, there are four big things that Obamacare did. Number one, it required that everyone would have insurance or pay a fine, the dreaded individual mandate, right? Second, it created these state exchanges, and these exchanges required that the people be offered guaranteed minimum benefit levels. Now, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, slightly over 11 million people are enrolled in these exchanges. Third, it increased regulation on the insurance industry in a lot of ways. Some of the main ways: you can't deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions. There are restrictions on what insurers can charge. There are requirements concerning the percentage of revenue that insurers must spend on claims. And also, kids can stay on parents' insurance until age 26. And there are a bunch of other things, but those are some of the main ones. Fourth, it expanded Medicaid. And now, initially, it was going to expand it in all 50 states, but that 2012 Supreme Court ruling in National Federation of Independent Businesses versus Sebelius made this voluntary. Now, after that, 31 states and the District of Columbia expanded, and so there were 19 non-expanding states. And at this point, there are 14.4 million additional people enrolled in Medicaid after Obamacare went through. And again, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation data, around 11 million of these people enrolled under this expanded eligibility. So that's roughly what Obamacare did. Now, in terms of, you have anything to add to that, Jay?
Well, I would just add, you know, when we talk about the exchanges, what we're talking about is the individual market, which is people who don't get health care through their employer or through some government program. And again, as we've said before, that piece of it is relatively small, and the Medicare expansion piece is really the much bigger part of it.
Yeah, that's an important point about that. So, you know, before we get into exactly the second part of this and how it worked, the theoretical basis, I want to thank Politics Guys listeners for taking the time to check out our sponsors to keep the show going, like today's first sponsor, SeatGeek. They're a great, low-cost, super convenient way to buy tickets for live events. Now, with SeatGeek, you can find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed, and it only takes a few taps on the app or a few clicks if you access it through their website, SeatGeek.com. Now, I've got the SeatGeek app, and it gives me all sorts of recommendations that are tailored exactly to my admittedly weird musical interests. So, you know, if there's anyone that I want to see that's coming to town, like recently I found out that Diana Krall, who I absolutely love, is going to be, you know, pretty close to the area. I'd love to see her. And if SeatGeek hadn't told me about that, I totally would have missed that, which would have been a bummer. And also with SeatGeek, you can get updates on whatever, you know, venues, events, performers you'd like to keep track of. And you can even connect it with Spotify, your music library, and Facebook and get notifications about people you listen to or follow. But if you're not a notification person, you can turn that off too, so it's not like necessarily annoying. And when you buy a ticket, they'll even put the day and the time of that event on your calendar if you want them to. And best of all, Politics Guys listeners, of course, there's a special deal for you. You get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code PoliticsGuy. That's all one word, no S, just plain PoliticsGuy. Or you can just go to SeatGeek.com and get your tickets that way. It's kind of very old school. And again, just enter that promo code on checkout, PoliticsGuy, for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Okay, so getting back to...
I don't think your musical taste is weird. I'd say it's eclectic.
There you go. Let's go with eclectic.
You got a lot of different stuff there.
Absolutely.
But back to healthcare.
Okay, so how Obamacare worked. I think this is important to understand. The analogy that's often used is that of a three-legged stool. And so what they mean by that is there are three components that are sort of interlocking. You take one of them away and the stool falls over, which obviously you don't want. So the first leg of this stool is something called guaranteed issue, meaning that insurance companies have to give insurance to people who want to buy it.
And that's sort of been the way things have worked for the last couple decades.
Well, yes and no. They could give
in the not in the individual market, but in the mass market.
Yeah,
when you get insurance through your employers
in the group.
But
yeah, exactly. But in the individual market, that was a different thing. So
now, it was not the case in the individual market.
Right. The second leg, what's called the individual mandate, and that's the idea that people were forced to buy insurance, or they pay a penalty, fine, tax, whatever word you want to use. There was obviously some controversy over what exactly that was. But now that's important because if you are essentially requiring people requiring insurance companies to give people insurance, and you're also regulating them in terms of saying you can't charge them so much that it makes it impossible for them to get it, well, That's going to be difficult for them unless you require healthy people to buy insurance to subsidize the sicker people. And so that's why those two things are interlocking. Now,
right. And I would say, and I would just add again for clarity, that's exactly the reason why, for example, when you would get insurance through your employer, they have a large pool of people. And you can do that guaranteed issue. And there is that healthy subsidizing the sick. And in the individual market, if you just show up and say, hi, I'd like to buy an insurance policy, the insurance companies would look at you not as a member of a group of what is your risk as a group member, but what is your risk as an individual. And that's what made individual policies so much more expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. So those are the first two legs. The third leg involves subsidies. And the subsidies are designed to make it possible for people, for poorer people who aren't quite poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, to actually be able to afford a reasonable health insurance plan. And so the theory is if you don't have all three of these things, the whole thing essentially falls apart. So that's the three-legged stool, and that's the kind of theoretical basis of the design of Obamacare. So moving on to the results. Well, the biggest result, as far as I'm concerned, is we have over 20 million people that are covered who weren't covered before. That's a big, big deal. And so by that benchmark, it's a pretty big success. Now, what conservatives will say,
as Joe Biden said, it's a big blank deal.
we
won't say that's a family show here, but okay. Yeah.
But that comes at a cost, of course. And the cost, now, depending on how you look at it, there are various estimates. But one estimate, I believe, for the CBO is the cost, if Obamacare continues on, will cost $1.2 trillion by 2025. And that's not counting various cost-curbing measures that are in the law that may or may not be as effective as some people think they are. So that's kind of at the higher end of that in one way. So now, looked at another way, that's around $120 billion a year, or roughly, and $120 billion a year is roughly 3.4% of the 2016 federal budget. Now, from my standpoint, that is a totally reasonable cost for the benefit of covering over 20 million people. Some conservatives have a very different view of this, obviously. So
I'd put in, though, and again, I'm not trying to be argumentative here, asterisk as far as when we say covered people, to the extent that they may have coverage, but in a lot of cases, it comes with a very high deductible, such that it might make the utilization of the coverage prohibitive, unless you've got something that is truly catastrophic.
Sure. You know, and that's not an unreasonable point, but I would say then kind of in response to that, well, at least, I mean, the biggest success of Obamacare has been the Medicaid expansion, where, like I said, there were over 11 million people who were covered under the expanded eligibility under Obamacare. And so that's not a question of affordability or not. Medicaid is but we'll get to Medicaid changes in just a minute. So. What does the Senate bill do? Well, it does a lot. I mean, by the standards of some major bills, it's kind of short, 142 pages, but there's a lot in there. So let me try to hit sort of what I consider the high points, so to speak. Number one, it keeps that guaranteed issue part. So that's that first leg of the stool. But it eliminates the individual mandate, which is the second leg of the stool. And it keeps... but it reduces the subsidies in some ways, increases them in other ways. That's the third leg of the stool. So basically, the stool falls over, which is why I think this is just an untenable thing. And actually, Rand Paul, of all people, agrees with me about this. Now, I never thought I'd say that. But in addition to that, it reduces coverage requirements. It allows states to more easily get waivers for requirements. Now, under the ACA, waivers are hard to get, and they're only granted if they don't result in a decrease in coverage. But under the Senate bill, they're a lot easier to get, and they're going to be granted essentially automatically unless they increase the deficit. Another thing the Senate bill does is it includes a big capital gains tax cut and other tax cuts, because why not, I guess. We'll talk about that in a minute. And finally, it doesn't just roll back Medicaid expansion to pre Obamacare status, but it fundamentally changes the nature of Medicaid. It takes it from an open-ended program where costs are determined by need to a per capita capped contribution program. And while it does use inflation to adjust funding in subsequent years, after a few years, it switches from the medical inflation rate to the overall inflation rate, which is lower. So that's basically what the Senate bill does. Jay, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that's a pretty good summary. Good. I mean, I can quibble with a couple things about the stool falling over and which leg is bigger and so forth. But no, I think that's pretty accurate. And I think you're right in that the biggest thing, the most substantial thing that the Senate bill does is, you know, changing Medicaid.
Yeah. So, you know, to me, my initial thought is this really demonstrates in a very stark way what the parties care about. I mean, the Republican Party, it seems to me, cares fundamentally about tax cuts, deregulation, and smaller government. Whereas, at least in this issue, what the Democrats care about, what liberals care about, is coverage for the people who have the greatest amount of trouble getting coverage. I mean, this is a clear demonstration of different priorities there. Well, would you agree with that, Jay?
Yes and no. I would say another, you know, big Republican piece in this. And you know, I'll tell you, this has been a little bit of a frustration to me because I think in a lot of ways, maybe Republicans framed this issue incorrectly from the beginning. And that's easy for me to say, and, you know, hindsight's 2020. But, you know, rather than the idea of just we're going to repeal Obamacare, saying, listen, we're going to take this out of the federal government and give it back to the states where it's more responsive. That would be the better way to have sold this, I think. Well, and they may still do that if they're going to take my advice. But I would say the big part as a Republican, something that I care deeply about is entitlement reform. And this would be with Medicare sort of the first significant step towards entitlement reform that we've seen, you know, since Bill Clinton, you know, changed welfare in 1994. So I think it's a big deal there. Is it, you know, actually going to happen? No, but I think this would be sort of a first step in giving the states more flexibility to deal with how they handle Medicaid.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I totally agree that it's a huge change, a major entitlement reform. But before I kind of give my response to that, I want to thank our second sponsor for today's show, ZipRecruiter. You know, good help is hard to find. I was lucky because when I had the idea to start the Politics Guys, before we even had a name for the show, I immediately thought of Jay. And Jay, do you know why? Well, because I knew you would be great for the show. And, you know, we had experience, we had history and so forth. And I think it's worked out, you know, really well. But most people aren't as lucky. Most people don't have can pull a J out of their back pocket, right? Which is very few. There aren't many J's going around. So that's where ZipRecruiter comes in. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100+ job sites with just one click. And then their powerful technology, it efficiently matches the right people to your job. They'll find your J's and they'll do it better than anyone else. And that's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike those other job sites, ZipRecruiter does not depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. There's no juggling emails or calls to your office. All you have to do is screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with their easy-to-use dashboard. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, Politics Guys listeners, you get about as good a deal as we can get. You can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. All you have to do, go to ZipRecruiter.com/politicsguy. That's ZipRecruiter.com/politicsguy. Not politics guy, just politics guy. One more time, because if I say it three times, it'll get lodged in your brain and you'll definitely check it out. We'll be thrilled. ZipRecruiter will be thrilled. And most important, you'll get a great person for your job opening. To try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/politicsguy. Okay, so Jay, my thoughts on the whole Medicaid thing, entitlement reform. Now, we're talking about huge cuts here. There are no CBO numbers yet. They should be coming this next week. But the House estimate was $839 billion in Medicaid cuts over 10 years. The Senate cuts are even deeper. And so what we're going to see from this, almost certainly, massive decreases in the Medicaid-covered population. Again, we don't have a CBO score yet, but the House score was 23 million, and fewer covered by 2026, and I expect the Senate score will be somewhere in that neighborhood. So that, to me, is the main cost. And to me, what we get for that, well, it pays for around $1 trillion in tax cuts, the vast bulk of which help out only the richest Americans. So to me, that's the trade-off. We're saying, you know what? We should give the top 1, 5, 10%, around $1 trillion in tax cuts, and we should give the people, the poorest people, less access to healthcare. Let's do that. That to me is kind of what it is. Now, there are a couple ways of looking at this. The one way of looking at it is, well, Republicans just hate the poor. Yeah, you're probably not going to look at that
way. That's it. You got it.
The second way to look at it, and this is really more the way I look at it, is I believe the Republicans have a fundamentally flawed theory of how the economy and how society works, and this religion of theirs that it's no such thing as cutting taxes on the richest too much, because you'll do that and the pie will grow enormously and everyone will be better off and so forth. That's true to an extent. But I think that Republicans go way, way, way overboard in this. And I think this is just another example of that. Jay, your take's going to be a little different. What is it?
Yeah, my take. Well, first of all, I would say I think that putting the capital gains tax cut, I think that's a tactical mistake in the healthcare bill. I mean, you think they should have done that later, waited for a tax reform bill, but that's beside the point. To me, the bigger point is, and I don't want to say, listen, I'm a Republican. I know a lot of Republicans. I serve on the board of a charitable nonprofit clinic that gives medical services to those who can't afford them. Many of the other members on that board are also Republican. Some aren't. But my point is, Republicans don't hate the poor. And there is this sort of caricature out there that anytime we talk about changing how something works, it's an attack on the poor, and I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think you need to look at our country's situation in terms of entitlements. It's out of control. That is the biggest piece of our budget by far, bigger than anything else. Bigger than defense. Bigger than any social program, bigger than PBS and all that kind of stuff that people like. And this is, if we're going to have changes in how our budget works, this is where it's going to have to happen. And yeah, there will be some pain in this, because there's going to be an adjustment period. That said, I don't see why Democrats are always so opposed to letting states step up and take over. Now, again, this is federal Medicare money. There's nothing that says the states can't do their own thing in terms of supplementing that. Many do. In fact, California has a proposal right now to create a single payer healthcare system, to which I, as a conservative, a federalist, say, well, go for it. Good luck. Let's see how it turns out. But I think that there's a lot that can be done at the state level. And the bigger piece of this is, if people don't like what's done at the state level, it's easier for them to change it and address it than it is through a one-size-fits-all federal solution. So to me, that's big. Now, again, at the tax cuts, I think that's was just, again, bad tactics. Maybe there's somebody smarter than me who's doing this, probably. But with the other part of it, yeah, I think that's fine. Now, going back to the exchanges and the individual mandate, I think we talked before that the number that sticks out in my head as far as the percentage of people who get their health care through the individual open market is something in the neighborhood of like 7%. And I think we need to start looking at that as that is a small outlier, and that's not where the biggest healthcare problems are. It's not in that 7% who get their funds through exchanges. It's the other 93, if I'm doing my math right. And the other issue that has to be addressed is because of the regulatory pieces that came in with Obamacare and some that were there well before Obamacare, the cost of healthcare keeps increasing on that 93%. And businesses are finding it tougher and tougher to insure their employees. And businesses mostly want to do that. They want to offer benefits to their employees. And again, that's different than the typical Democrat doctrine, but my experience, it's true. So I think Republicans ought to point out, no, we don't hate the poor, but we love most everyone here who's going to have these tremendous healthcare increases if this isn't fixed.
But here's the thing, to me at least. It's one thing repealing Obamacare, but Senate Republicans decided we're going to go even further than that. And we're going to, because you're right about, you know, the individual marketplace as being a minority segment of, you know, who's covered or where people get their coverage. But the single biggest source of healthcare coverage for people in the United States is Medicaid. And so here the House Republican, sorry, Senate Republican said,
Medicaid
covers more people.
And then Medicaid, I think, is probably smaller.
Medicaid covers more people than anything else. And here's the thing is that Senate Republicans said, we're not just going to take things back to where they were before Obamacare. We're going to push the envelope and we're going to take, you know, almost $900 billion out of the single biggest healthcare program in the United States. And that to me is incredibly irresponsible and short-sighted and just downright wrong. And especially, you know, you talk about unsustainable costs. Again, according to these CBO numbers, $120 billion a year, 3.4% of the 2016 budget. When you take a look at what we're spending in other areas, like, for instance, defense spending, that is it's not a pittance. It's not exactly a big deal. And so to me, it's a question of priorities. Do we want to spend an extra, or could we find $120 billion to cut from defense and give to poor people in need of medical care? Geez, I hope so. But apparently that's not the priority for Republicans in the Senate. And that to me is deeply, deeply disappointing.
Well, or I would put it a different way, because I think you're just coming at it from certain assumptions, and that is, could the states provide the same amount of care or better tailored care than the federal government for a lower price tag?
Except I don't think they can. I understand what you're saying. I mean,
And look, if they can't, well, we're going to find out about it, and people will be angry at the state level, and the states will have to step up to do something about it.
But as you know, Jay, the states have a lot less ability to do that because the states are far more fiscally constrained than the federal government, and they have far fewer resources.
Because states have to have a balanced budget, and the federal government doesn't.
Right.
But again, looking long term, this is the way. You know, it's funny. We've had this type of conversation on other issues, like college aid and so forth. That, to some extent, anytime you've got a lot of federal funding being pumped into a system, it creates a bubble. It creates the inflation. I look at this as, here's a way to say, we're not going to inflate that bubble anymore. What we're going to start doing is looking for efficiencies and ways to do this better and cheaper. That's eventually, if we don't do that, we're going to run into an unsustainable situation with entitlements at law in as a whole, but Medicaid in particular.
Well, I'm all for better and cheaper. I mean, who wouldn't be, right? I mean, but to me, the idea that Medicaid is kind of pushing or creating a bubble. I mean, Medicaid payments are what states tend to do to try to make their Medicaid dollars go as far as possible. They cut payments as much as possible. And so doctors, hospitals actually get a lot less from Medicaid than they do for, you know, for Medicare or for other types of coverage.
So absolutely. The Medicaid reimbursement is much lower, and doctors and hospitals who do provide Medicaid services do so at essentially at a loss. Which again is sort of another problem with the idea of we want more people covered by Medicaid. That's more loss in the system, and that loss is eventually made up for by folks who aren't in Medicaid, and through Medicare and through other revenue sources that those doctors and hospitals need to tap. So, you know, it is all tied together, and I. You know, I think something else that we didn't talk about with Medicaid is that fact that providers often have to operate at a loss to treat Medicaid patients means that there are fewer providers who want to take on new Medicaid patients. And I can tell you that's something that you know I've seen in my own personal experience as a board member on the nonprofit. There's a provider shortage, and adding more to the Medicaid roles, I think that's you know problematic. Just deepens that shortage. And
I would say, and I understand what you're saying, and I agree to a certain extent. And I would say the answer to that is to A, expand the roles, and B, expand the amount of money we put into it, and find that money elsewhere by either cutting things that I think are somewhat bloated, like defense, or by raising taxes on people who are best able to afford that. I think that's one of the components of a decent society, is where those who have more contribute to the well-being of those who need a helping hand. But
there's a good argument to say that's already our situation. But
it is to a certain extent.
I get it. Yeah. If you want more, but.
You know, let's talk about the politics of this, though. So, yeah. in its current form, what do you think the likelihood of the Senate bill passing is at this point?
Zero.
Zero. Okay. Well, that's the firm stance. The betting markets tend to agree with you.
I don't know anything in particular. They don't read in the paper, but is you know what I'm reading. You know, we've got a three vote margin. You have a number of the conservatives, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, saying, listen, the problem is, to put it in the way you might phrase it, it's not mean enough to poor people, or as they might phrase it, it's not going to do enough to reduce premiums. And then you also have more moderate Republicans, for example, Olympia Snowe of the main delegation, and then also, and I'm forgetting the name of the senator from Nebraska, or Nevada, I'm sorry. But I think Nebraska also. I mean, what the problem is, you've got, it's getting hit from both sides. There are moderates who are uncomfortable with it, and there are conservatives who are uncomfortable with it. So I think there's going to have to be something that will be done. I think Mitch McConnell is smart enough to know this, to have set this out in such a way that there's going to be changes. There's going to be room to move to get the people he needs to get eventually. But I would say as it stands now, as this bill is right now, will we have a vote next week that will pass this? I would say no.
Yeah, I would.
In its current form, yeah, I would say no.
I would agree that in its current form, or I don't necessarily even think there's going to be passage of it before the Independence Day break. But I think at some point after that a bill will go through, and Republicans will get a bill to President Trump's desk to sign that will fundamentally change healthcare again in the United States. And I think for the worse, but I hope I'm wrong about that, certainly. Okay, moving on. The other really big story this week was the special election in Georgia to fill the seat of noted Obamacare opponent Tom Price, who President Trump chose to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. Now, in the first round of balloting on April 18th, the Democratic newcomer John Ossoff fell just short of the majority he needed to win outright over the entire field, which included a bunch of Republicans. And this gave Democrats hope that they could win in what had been for decades a deep red Republican district. Price won by like 23 points in his last election. But their hopes were dashed this week. Ossoff wasn't able to improve on his 48% total from the first vote. And with the Republicans coalescing around Karen Handel, his sole Republican challenger, Ossoff went down to defeat. Jay, what do you make of all this?
First, I want to say I completely called this several months ago when we first talked about the primary election, and there was excitement among the Democrats that, oh, this is a seat we can pick up. And I said, no, it's not. And a zillion reasons for that. Number one is districts are what they are. Second, primary elections are different than general elections. And third, congressional elections are different than presidential elections. And I think so much of the Democratic hope was based on that Trump had sort of a poor showing or less of a good showing than people thought he ought to, underperformed, let's say, in that district. But at that time, I made the point that there were a lot of places where Trump won but underperformed, and the Republican congressional or senatorial candidate did better. So I mean, yeah, absolutely, there were Republicans who have qualms, concerns, feel queasy about voting for Trump. But in a traditional Republican district that's been Republican for forever, that's in the South in a fairly affluent place, that's strong Republican territory. And if you pump enough money into it, you can make just about any race competitive, but it's still really difficult to overcome the demographics of a district.
Yeah, I think that's a great analysis. A lot of folks on my side are freaking out, saying that the Democrats need to fundamentally change their message and that sort of thing. I honestly think it's an overreaction. I mean,
they needed to have a different message for that district.
Well, I think they needed more than anything else a different candidate.
Agreed. Yeah.
I hate to say this. I never thought I'd say this, but I completely agree with Fox News's Tucker Carlson on this. I almost feel like I need to wash my mouth. But here's what he said about the race. He said, Democrats still have literally no idea why they keep losing elections. If they did, they would have run a real candidate with a real job who understands the constituents he's attempting to represent. I mean, who was John Ossoff? A 30-year-old guy who's never held office, who's definitely culturally out of touch with the district and doesn't even live there. I get why that would attract a lot of support from liberals across the country. I saw a lot of him that I liked, but that's not how you win an election. To me, this is, in a way, kind of a similar thing with the presidential election. Hillary Clinton was, like, as far as I'm concerned, the worst possible candidate Democrats could have picked for different reasons. And so this is, again, to me, another example of Democrats picking a bad candidate. And it's not about the overall message. It's, about this individual bad candidate thing. So I don't think Democrats need to really worry that much or freak out that much, because in all four of the special elections so far, Democrats have significantly outperformed the data-driven expectations of how they should have done. And I think that bodes really well for the party in 2018. That said, having a win would have definitely made candidate recruitment a little bit easier and maybe even led to a few more Republican retirements, which would have been nice. But Democrats we don't need to freak out. Really, it's going to be, I don't know if we're going to take the House in 2018. I certainly hope so. There's a lot in our favor, just the very fact that the party in power tends to lose seats, especially when you have a president who's deeply unpopular. So we got that going for us. So I don't think people need to be wailing and gnashing their teeth. It would have been nice to pick up this district, but it's going to be okay. I really believe that. Jay, any other thoughts on that?
Well, it's kind of, Cavaliers fans consoling themselves saying, look, the national sports media predicted a Warrior sweep and it was 4-1.
That's a bad analogy. It's a bad analogy because it would have been that if they were predicting a Warrior sweep and then the Warriors would have won narrowly in game seven. Very different thing. So, but I mean, I know what you're saying. It would have been nice, you know, Republicans are 4-0 in these races, but they were expected to win all these races. So, and well, we played them closer than any we had reason to expect based on historical trends. So I feel, you know, if not, I certainly don't feel overconfident, but I think, you know, 2018 is definitely going to see a lot fewer Republicans in the House, thank God, and maybe even a Democratic majority, but we'll see.
I'm going to rain on your parade a little bit. Going back to what you said on the right, having the right candidate, because I think you're right. There's a lot there that if they had the right candidate, they can win some of these districts. But the problem is the Democrat Party has moved so far left, and the people who are bubbling up. And also there's this consistent argument that we've talked about before about just bench strength. We talk about that more in presidential and senatorial terms than House terms, because House terms are guys who are just kind of coming up from the minors most of the time. But still, I don't know that you're going to find, you know, on the Facebook page I posted, you know, if you had someone, a conservative Democrat, Southerner, much like a, you know, Senator Sam Nunn, a much younger version of Sam Nunn or something, running in that district, I think Democrats with all that money might have been able to win it. But I don't see those kind of people out there on the horizon or entering these races.
No, and that's a fair point.
That's the thing. I think you're right. If you had a better candidate, you could win. And again, if we had Kevin Durant, the Cavs, I think, would have won.
No, that's
we don't have Kevin Durant.
That is a good point. I think that then, you know, when you talk about the minor leagues in this kind of analogy are oftentimes state legislatures. And that's where Democrats have taken a beating since 2010. And that's
those Democrats that are holding on are the ones from the really safe, really liberal progressive districts. So it's necessarily a tough climb.
Sure. And that's one of the headwinds.
Raining on your parade.
Yeah. No. That said,
I completely agree with the you know, party in power typically suffers defeats in their first term.
Absolutely. So, you know, given how much both the healthcare bill and that special election dominated the news this week, pretty much everything else, I think, flew under the radar. But one of those under the radar stories that we want to talk about is sanctions against Russia. On Tuesday, the Trump administration unveiled new sanctions against Russia, targeting 38 people and organizations that played a role in the country's military intervention into Ukraine, which began in 2014, just a little bit of history here, when Ukrainians removed from power their really impressively corrupt and very Russia-friendly president, Viktor Yanukovych. And in addition, this last week, the Senate passed a sanctions bill by the vote of 98-2. That's right, 98-2. Which also includes sanctions on Iran, as well as provisions that would require the Trump administration to obtain Congress's approval before removing sanctions. Now, the House has held up this bill, arguing that it would raise revenue, and therefore it has to begin in their chamber. The administration has also expressed some concern. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has argued that Congress shouldn't tie the president's hands and that the administration needs the flexibility to turn the heat up on Russia or turn it down as Russia's behavior dictates. Jay, what do you think?
I thought Trump loved Russia. What are we doing? I think it's as your guest on the interview last week said, I was hating Russia before hating Russia was cool. So, I'm fine with sanctioning the Russians. I would agree. There is what you're seeing with the House and with the administration pushing back a little bit on, well, it ought to begin in the House and then the administration. We need more flexibility. Those are sort of the institutional tensions that we sort of would want to see and expect to see. And I think that's, you know, just probably par for the course. But no, absolutely, I'm in favor of getting tough with the Russians. And bully for the Senate.
Yeah. You know,
who are the two? No,
I don't know. Yeah. I forgot to check, but you got to wonder, maybe they thought the sanctions weren't harsh enough. I don't know, but yeah, I should have checked on that. Oh, but 98 to 2.
It's sort of like it's 1954 again, right? I mean, it's, you know, all right.
You know, the first thing I thought, loving it. The first thing I thought was, I think it's fair to say that at least on this area, Vladimir Putin is not a geopolitical genius, because if he thought that helping Donald Trump win the election, which certainly Russia tried to do, that would lead to some benefit for Russia. Boy, that was a major miscalculation. That blew up in his face. You know, and I honestly think that Vladimir Putin fundamentally cares most about Vladimir Putin and not necessarily about Russia in any way. I think he's an awful human being, but that's another story. But in any case, wow, big miscalculation for Putin. And hey, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Hey, can I just jump in on the Putin bit a little bit?
Because yeah,
I think there's something that was some articles a couple weeks ago, and we didn't talk about them, but that, you know, look, to the extent that did Putin want to elect Trump, or did Putin just want to sort of throw our system into chaos? And to the extent he did the latter, then I think he did succeed. And his point there isn't so much to elect someone he believes will be friendly to him, but just to kind of throw a wrench into the works. And then also on the domestic front to say, look what a mess the West is. You don't want any of this democracy nonsense.
Yeah, I guess you could be right on that. But I think at least in the short term, it certainly is costing him in terms of, you know, billions in sanctions and so forth. But yeah, that's another way.
He's got billions. He'll be fine. As you pointed out. It's,
yeah, exactly. You know, like, but, you know, this is a case where, again, I'm in the odd position of saying I sort of agree with Rex Tillerson and the administration, at least on the sanctions bill. I think as a general rule, it's better to allow the president and his team to conduct foreign policy than to get Congress too involved in the process. And so I get Secretary of State Tillerson's point on this, and I think it's a reasonable point, given how slowly Congress moves on this, and I sort of see the point.
Yeah, that oftentimes there are more things going on, sort of behind the scenes than we see on the nightly news, and lots of little moving pieces. Sometimes, you know, Congress using the big blunt instrument isn't helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. So even though I'm a little reluctant to give this administration more control over foreign policy, especially with Russia, I think as a sort of a longer term sort of thing, I sort of see the logic in that. So there we go. All right. So it's time for what we're reading, where we step back from the crazed pace of the news cycle and talk about the things that we're reading, listening to, or watching that are maybe a little more in-depth, contextual, that sort of thing. So, Jay, you want to start off this week, or do you want me to?
I'll start off. And again, I'm terrible with this, because I always tend to be sort of the last thing I read, and then it's like, yeah, that's what I got to talk about. But this was from yesterday's Wall Street Journal, in their review section, a sort of lengthy article about Venezuela by David Ludenau and Jose de Cordora, and really documenting how terrible things have gotten in Venezuela. I don't know whether we have any listeners in Venezuela, but we'd like to hear from you. And just to put that in perspective, because one of my big things I like to do is bring perspective to the problems we have in the U.S. and in the West in general. And our problems are trivial compared to what's going on there, where they have right now 720% inflation. It is expected to surpass 2,000% inflation next year. People are literally scrounging for food, and this isn't, you know, again, you know, a homeless person or someone who is derelict. This is the masses of people, and the government is rampantly corrupt. There were trillions of dollars in oil revenues that were flowing in the early part of the 2010s, which were diverted to Chavez friends and later Maduro's friends, that is just simply unaccounted for. And you have a small class of people who are extremely rich, and not extremely rich because they were extremely rich through their own hard work or good investments, but extremely rich because they're friends of the government. And to me, this is an example, and, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but we haven't seen of, look, here is sort of socialism in action. And I know everyone, when they say, hear the word socialism, like thinks, oh, it's, you know, Scandinavia where everybody's got free healthcare or something. But in the real world, you have this kind of system where you've got a couple people at the top and the government controls so much, that they pick winners and losers, and the losers are often, the people. So, I would like ask people to take a look at that. And again, it puts a lot of things in perspective, and it also shows how quickly, things can turn. Venezuela was really, celebrated, to some extent as a Latin or a South American success story. It was living mostly off of oil revenues. And then when oil dropped, it sort of fell apart, along with sort of the other instabilities that were already there. Once the oil went away, I couldn't hold things up anymore.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you entirely. The one difference I have was I'd say that's an example of what happens when you do not have strong institutions and rule of law. Things break down incredibly quickly. And, you know, you can look to Venezuela. You can look to even to Russia, which we're talking about, where there are all kinds of awful things going on there.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
You don't have strong institutions and rule of law. And it really is tragic. Good government, good institutions matter an incredible amount.
And well, I would say that it's worse in Venezuela. In Russia, you can say, look, you never really had those institutions. There was sort of, you know, an incipient democracy, you know, that sort of blossomed for a couple years, maybe in the early 90s. But that it never had a strong democratic tradition to look back to, like other places in Eastern Europe, for example. Once communism fell, fell back on their old democratic institutions. Venezuela was a country that, by South American standards, had developed sort of some democratic institutions, but that progress has been reversed.
Yeah,
so
absolutely. All right. This week, my recommendation is a policy podcast that's actually been around for a few years, but it's new to me. It's called The Brookings Cafeteria. It's a podcast from the Brookings Institution, which is a center-left think tank that's been around for just a little over 100 years now. They're pretty much the granddaddy of policy shops, and one of the first places that I go to when I'm looking for solid scholarly policy analysis. And now I usually try to balance them out with the center-right American Enterprise Institute, another great think tank. Their latest,
love those guys.
Yeah, well, I know you would. Their latest episode in the Brookings cafeteria is on net neutrality. But there's also, if you're not interested in that issue, which I think you should be, there's also a ton of great stuff in their past show archives. I know I'm going to be digging through that for quite a while. So again, I highly recommend the Brookings cafeteria.
Yeah, I've never listened to the podcast, but I can't say listen. Lots of times I disagree with some of the conclusions that the Brookings folks come up with. But there are a lot of smart people and have been a lot of smart people there. They were almost like the original think tank.
Yeah.
Whatever they put out, I think it's worth looking at.
Definitely. All right. Well, that does it for this episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We hope you like what you heard and that you'll check out today's sponsors, whose support is really critical to keeping the show going. First, we have SeatGeek, the easy way to get great low-cost tickets to live events, where Politics Guys listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download their app and enter promo code PoliticsGuy, all one word, no S. Today, that's promo code PoliticsGuy for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. And ZipRecruiter, where you can post your job to 100 plus sites with just one click. And Politics Guys listeners get post for free on ZipRecruiter. That's right, free. You just go to ZipRecruiter.com/politicsguy. And hey, if you've got a question, comment, correction, or just a random thought you want to share with us, reach out at mail@politicsguys.com or on our Facebook page where you can message us or anywhere we post throughout the week, facebook.com/politicsguys page. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.